Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. This is a much anticipated edition of the Grant Williams Podcast, partly by me and partly by everybody who's written to me asking for the return of my guest today after his tour de force appearance at this time last year. The man in question is Felix Zulauf of Zulauf Consulting, and I get the chance once a year to talk to Felix. He very graciously agrees to give up some of his time to sit and chat with me, and I'm always just so thrilled to be able to share those conversations with you. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with the magnificent Felix Zulauf. Felix, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a year. I'm so happy to see you again. Thanks for doing this.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me again, Grant.
Well, the invitation is an open one. You know that. You're welcome back anytime. You know, since you and I last spoke, which is a year ago now, I cannot tell you how many emails I've had from people saying, we need Felix back on the podcast. We want to know what Felix thinks about the world. And we began last time, I asked you a very simple question about your roadmap going forward, and you gave such a fantastically comprehensive answer. And I know people have played that over and over and over again and listened to it and taken notes on it. So I think as a jumping off point this time, I think we'll do exactly the same thing. And I'll just give you the floor to lay out how you see the world right now, the way you look at what potentially could happen from here, and the areas you're focusing on where we might see some action. So take as much time as you want, and then I guarantee you I'll have a whole list of dumb questions to ask you about them afterwards.
Okay. Well, you know, the basic roadmap that I laid out a year ago is still valid. It has changed a little bit in terms of timing, but the roadmap in general is still valid. I believe we are in for geopolitical upheavals, and I have been writing about coming conflicts and wars for 5 years now. And it started in 22. There was another problem in Israel and Gaza. And it's not the last one. It will continue. And I think it will eventually escalate, and the risk for a broader conflict pulling in the US and Russia, et cetera, is rising. I think it's rising. We can talk about this sometimes later. Economically, you know, the world economy is sort of exhausted. It is not breaking down, but the world economic growth is at about 1.5% in real terms. Historically, that has been called a recession, historically. And you see it in global trade. Global trade year over year is in negative territory, and clearly so. So the world economy is not doing well. And there are different parts of the world economy. China is not doing that well. We know the problem. We talked about it. It's a structural problem that will accompany us for many, many years. I think the Chinese understand it. They are on it, and they will solve it over time. But you cannot expect China to go into a major stimulation program like the Americans or even the Europeans do from time to time at this time. They don't do that. First of all, there are important elections coming up in Taiwan in mid-January, and they do not want it to create a booming Chinese economy to benefit Taiwan and benefit the wrong parties. And so that's China. I think China is muddling through, but not more than that. It will not be a factor to help global growth. It will be a factor to restrain global growth in the years to come. Europe is stagnant or recession-like, the European situation, and I do not see much change there. You know, countries like Germany are running into major financial difficulties, and it could even be that they have to tighten fiscal policy next year, as is probably due in the US. You know, So I do not expect Europe to contribute. On a rate of change basis, some of the economic numbers look like they are improving from a very low level in negative territory. But that is just due to mathematics and the base effect. The level of economic activity remains subdued and it's stagnant-like, and the risk of falling into a deeper recession next year is high. And then comes the U.S., and the U.S. is the one economy that has surprised everyone. It has done much better than expected, and some of the numbers we have seen have been very robust. And this is surprising in view of the rising interest rates and what we thought was a tightening going on in monetary terms, etc. I'm not very clear how exactly it will work out. I could easily see that the first part of the year could surprise on the upside in terms of economic numbers. But I think if that happens, the bond market will tighten. The Fed will not hike further, probably, but the bond market will tighten further, and then we have a problem, and then the economy will weaken. So I think in 24, the recession risk for the U.S. is quite high. When you look at the markets and the positioning, it's very interesting that, and I always do that, I always look at what are the most extreme consensus expectations, because that tells you how the market is positioned. And at present time, soft landing, I think almost 80% of the global fund managers are for soft landing. And hard landing is very down on the list. And so something else will happen. When you have an extreme consensus like this, either the economy will surprise on the upside or on the downside. I think we will see both, first on the upside and then on the downside. And the other extreme expectations linked to and related to the soft landing thesis is that bond yields will decline. It's very rare that you see global fund managers saying that 54% were saying that bonds will be the best asset class and not stocks. And I think it was only 25% going for equities. So this is very rare. And when you see consensus like that, you see how extreme they are positioned. A recent survey by the Treasury desk at JP Morgan showed the percentage of how many of their clients are long. And it was the most extreme ever in history. So it tells you that everybody is long bonds and expecting bond yields to decline further. They may do so eventually, but they may do so by using a detour. And my hunch is that we zigzag down now. We bounced off 420. That is an important support. I think we will break through 420 early next year, probably through 370 or something like that, and then bounce back, and we could see higher highs. That would be shocking to the markets, and it would shock not only bond managers and bond investors. If we go, let's say, to 550 or 570, it would shock the stock market. And I think the stock market is in the third leg from the lows in fall of 22. You know, we had that decline in 22, which we expected. And then I said we bounced back to 4,100, 4,200 in the S&P, and then we go down again. Then we didn't go down. And from April to July, the S&P went from 4,200 to 4,600, which I had trouble with, quite honestly. And then at 4,600, I said, we go down again. And in late October, I said, we have to change. We will see another up leg. And I think the up leg lasts into Q1 of next year. We do not know whether it will be a powerful up leg or whether it will be a more hesitant upleg. I think it will be a very volatile upleg. And the first part of the upleg is behind us, and we are now correcting. I think we are now in for a sharp sell-off down to 4,300 or something like that. So as a trader, I'm short term. My hunch is that this decline could last 1 to 2 weeks only, big shakeout, because the consensus was so extreme. And then we go higher, because over the year end, I expect the central banks to be relatively generous, to provide enough liquidity. And then the question will come out sometimes in Q1 when the rally gets tired and ends, whether the central bank are ready to tighten or not. And if they don't, and I think inflation, the decline in inflation is more or less, I mean, it could go down a little bit more for another 2 months or so. And then I think in the first half of 24, inflation will hit bottom and then it will begin to rise. And the bond market will probably see that and react. And then we also have a situation where in the market, we have a concentration like never before. When you look at markets that have a high concentration in a few stocks, those are risky markets. We had the last time we had such a concentration was in 2000, TMT, but those were probably 50 stocks. And going further back, it was in 73 when we had the Nifty 50s. And now it's seven stocks. And I have seen surveys that said that the largest hedge funds have 70% of their assets under management in 10 stocks. So that tells you it's a big concentration. Everybody who wanted to perform this year had to be in those stocks. If you were not in those stocks, you underperformed. And as a professional money manager fighting for survival, you had to be in those stocks. So everybody in those stocks. And you have to understand how this has been developing. The indexing, the passive investing and buying index funds is in fashion for many years now. And it's been a trend going on for a long time. And 62% of the global market cap is US. So if everyone outside in the world invests in the world index, 62% goes to the US. And in the US, 30% goes to seven stocks, basically. So it is a dramatic concentration. And my hunch is that when this rally fades and reverses, sometimes in Q1, then you will not have a normal plain vanilla correction, but you will most likely see a crash-like disaster. Because everybody who has to sell those stocks. And I think, you know, a surprise event in the first quarter, I cannot tell you what it is. It could be the bond market. It could be geopolitics. But when markets are one-sided and loaded up to the eyeballs in a few stocks, you know, the risk is very high for disaster. So I would see a big shakeout next year. And when I look at my indicators, we have the chance in 2024 that we have one of those rare years where we have an important high and an important low in the same year. That is not very often. 22 was one of those. 20 was one of those. 18 was one of those, and then you have to go further back, 87, 1987, and 1962, and I think 1937. So it is not very often that you see that. That tells me that the magnitude of volatility that we will see over the next 12 months will be dramatic. And I think investors should keep that in mind and have a very open mind of how to play this market, because when this rally ends in Q1, I think we are in for a very nasty shakeout. And the shakeout, the way I read the markets, is that we could underpot lows of fall of 22. So we could easily end up in the low 3,000 in the S&P 500, which would be from the high 4,000s down to the low 3,000s, it's a long way. But it could happen in 10 weeks. It could happen very quickly. That's what I see for 24. Thereafter, I think if the markets are down as much as I expect, and if the economic problems are as severe as I expect, and I do not expect a very severe recession, but I expect problems and I expect more social unrest and the polarization, the migration issues in Europe and in the US will intensify and all that, then I think the authorities will do what they ever do when there is a problem. They will stimulate, and then we will have a run. I expect a run to new highs, 6,000, 7,000 in the S&P before it's all over. Because when they stimulate, and that's the next cycle, when they stimulate, they will stimulate the commodity sector as well. And the commodity sector nowadays is controlled by the BRICS. And, 75% of world commodities are in the hands of the BRICS. So in the conflict that we have between the autocratic system and the democratic systems and nations, it's very clear to me that the autocratic BRICS will likely play that card and curtail supply to get the prices up. And that is a double whammy for us, because that will lead to oil prices of $150, $200 in 26 and other commodities going up as well. Not because demand is so fantastic, but because supply will be contained. And that means that in the next cycle, we have inflation rates higher than the 10%. We go above 10%. And from the 1970s, we know that it was the second inflation cycle that hurt the bond market as much. The bond market in the last few years had the most severe downdraft and decline in percentage terms in 70 years or something like that. And I think the next cycle will probably be even more severe. So we could easily see 8 or 10 year treasuries later in the decade, something very crazy. Because what we need is to fix our fiscal problems. We need a severe crisis. Nothing will happen without a severe crisis, and the bond vigilantes have to do it. The authorities will not do it. The bond vigilantes have to do it, and therefore it will be very severe. And that tells you where the stock market then will go at that time. So a big roller coaster decade. Nothing has changed from my big picture except the timing. And the timing has really changed because the banking crisis in March, I always said I expect an event, some event happening that triggers a decline in the market and an easing by the central banks. We didn't get much of a decline. We got the easing by the central banks. And I think this easing was a big mistake because it prolonged the cycle and it will make the work for central bankers in the future much harder. So I stop here and give you room for questions.
Well, look, it's such a treat to have you have the time and the space to lay that out, because otherwise you get into the weeds of questions and get distracted. And we now have a fantastic backdrop about which to talk. And I guess my first question comes back to the very beginning of that. And you mentioned China. Two parts to that. You talked about the geopolitical side of things and potential conflicts and the US and Russia being drawn in to those conflicts. You didn't mention China, so which I'm interested about. It was more the US and Russia. And secondly, the idea that China won't stimulate to solve their problems. And I'm curious as to what a world looks like absent Chinese stimulus, because we haven't really seen the world without Chinese stimulus for some time. And I'm interested to wonder how important that is to the market functioning the way we've become used to it. And also this idea about the geopolitical side. So let's focus on China. Talk a little bit about the effect on the world that China not stimulating will have, and also the ways in which they could get potentially drawn into this broader conflict.
Okay, let me take the second question first, why they will not stimulate as much as the West expects. They will stimulate, but but they will only stimulate as much that they keep the system going and that the system remains afloat. But they will not stimulate to the degree to create the high growth that the Westerners are often expecting. So that's an important difference. What's interesting when you really look closely at the Chinese situation, in the last few months, the Chinese have not stimulated, they have not eased, they have tightened. They have tightened monetary policy, and they did so because when the dollar was strong, the currency came under pressure, and they feared that the currency would break down. And they tightened to support the currency. Now with the dollar weakening, that they can ease a little bit. You know, they can ease a little bit. But they look at those things. And I think the Chinese Communist Party and the government, they see the problems and analyze the problems in the world much better than the Western world. I think the Western governments, in terms of quality leadership, is the worst I have seen in my lifetime. And that's not only for the US, that's also for Canada and Europe. You know, it's, the West is just horrible. And I think the autocratic leaders are better analysts. They are more farsighted, and they have a vision and a game plan, which the West does not have. So that's for China. What the geopolitical setup is concerned, you are right. The major conflict is between the US and China. Since World War II, actually, we had in the Western world, we had the unipolar US-centric model and world order. And the U.S. always told everybody how to behave. And if they didn't behave the way they should, according to the U.S., they intervened. And they changed regimes, et cetera, et cetera. When the wall came down, that continued. And then we had a unipolar U.S.-centric world order for 30 years. Up to the point when the Chinese came up and said, hey, listen, that's not in our interest. We have a different view. We also want to have our influence and we want to have a saying. And I think the old unipolar US-centric world order has crumbled, is gone, doesn't exist anymore. And everybody knows it except the US and the European governments. They don't understand it. They are still trying to defend the old world order that doesn't exist anymore. And that creates conflict. And when you have the top dog in the world in such a weak position as it presently is, then you have all sorts of hidden potential conflicts popping up, coming to the surface. That was in Serbia so, that in Armenia the case, that is now in Guyana the case, etc. And we will see more of that. And the Ukraine situation was, of course, the Russians attacked, but the Russians were provoked. And they were provoked because the U.S. was afraid of the Eurasian continental plate developing into an integrated economic system, because trade between Germany and China was bigger than trade between Germany and the U.S. There is a railroad for cargo from Beijing to Germany and things like that. So you had the cheap labor in Asia, technology in China and in Western Europe. You had commodities in Russia. And those are 4.5 billion people. That is powerful. You know, NAFTA is one-tenth of this. And I think the U.S. said, if we don't want to lose our influence on Europe, we have to break that. And Ukraine was the break. So they organized the regime change in Ukraine. That's a fact. That is obvious. Then they invited Ukraine into NATO. And there was no way that Russia could accept that. So Russia had no chance and had to intervene. And I said from the beginning, Ukraine will lose. And now it's a fact. You know, Ukraine has lost that war. Recently, Ukrainian state television even said they lost 1.1 million men in the military, death, wounded, missed, imprisoned. And then Zelensky intervened and they withdrew that news story. I was operating with about 500,000. And you have to understand that the Ukrainian military at first was 700,000 only, and then they increased to 900,000. Now they are recruiting male and female between age 17 to 70. This sounds like Germany in late 1944. So it's a desperate situation. And Zelensky and Putin had an agreement 2 months after the war started in Istanbul, where they agreed that eastern Ukraine, the Donbas, would stay inside the Ukraine with special authorities, that Ukraine would not become a member of NATO, and that Crimea would remain Russian. They agreed to that. But then Biden said, we don't agree to it, you continue to fight. So it's a tragedy what happens. And I think it's the neocons in the US that are behind it. And it's a tragedy. So we have the same thing in the Middle East when we talk about geopolitics, because Hamas attacked probably because Iran said so. Iran has now the nuclear bomb. They can produce 6 nuclear bombs in 30 days. And if they need it immediately, Pakistan said they will provide them some. And Saudi Arabia wanted to have the nuclear technology as well. So they asked the Americans, we want the nuclear technology for commercial reasons, of course, they said, because they have no oil down there and they need nuclear technology. And the U.S. said, we can help you, but you have to make peace with Israel. And the rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia happened. This was a problem for Iran because it would change the regional power situation in the Middle East. Therefore, we had that massacre, that horrible event. Right now, it seems the Arab nations have agreed. They are all on the same side and in the same boat. Saudi Arabia will provide some economic assistance to Iran, and Iran will keep quiet for the time being. My fear is that Netanyahu, who is in trouble domestically because he was prosecuted for corruption, and as long as there is war, there is no prosecution, that he will, after the Gaza operation, turn to Hezbollah. And if he turns to Hezbollah, it's Lebanon and Syria. And if he attacks Syria, Syria has a military agreement with Russia, so the Russians get pulled in. And the Iranians get pulled in. And if they attack Iran, then the Iranians will close the Straits of Hormuz, which is 20% of the world's oil goes through that strait every day. So that would probably give us rather $400 oil and our system would melt. So we are in for some nasty surprises in geopolitics. The situation is very unstable. I recently listened to Neil Ferguson, the famous historian, and 6 months ago or 8 months ago, he was relatively moderate about the geopolitical situation. And then I listened to him 2 months ago in Zurich in a small group. And I thought he was telling the group exactly what I'm telling my subscribers all the time. And he said the geopolitical situation is much more dangerous than everybody understands. And this was before Hamas. And there will be more wars, he said. And I asked him, where are the diplomats? Because this would be the high time for high-caliber diplomats, like Kissinger in the old days. And he said, to our disappointment, they do not exist. We don't have any. And that's the problem of the West. We do not have our diplomats that could solve these problems in a diplomatic way. And therefore, the risk of military conflicts is much higher. Did I answer your questions a little bit?
Well, you did, but you also gave me about 25 more, which is what you always do when we talk about these things. So let me ask you, because there are two sides to this conflict, obviously, as there is to every conflict. We have, on the one hand, the US withdrawing, as they did in Afghanistan, and sending clear signals that they are withdrawing from global situations because they're too stretched to do it. And the will at home, the political will at home, is waning. And on the other side, you have a potential opportunity for Saudi Arabia, for example, for Iran, for other nations in that region to capitalize on not just America's declining willingness to be involved in extraterritorial conflict, but also its increasing inability to fund these things. So how much of this escalating conflict do you think is countries such as Netanyahu, for example, you say whether the conflict is useful for him for domestic political reasons? How much of it is that? And how much of it is a sense of opportunity among, let's focus primarily on the BRICS nations, but certainly that part of the world, who sense now there is a chance here for us to capitalize on America's declining economic strength, capitalize on its declining willingness to be involved in other parts of the world, and we can now stake a claim for what we believe is rightfully ours, which is a much more robust presence on the world stage?
Oh, yeah. The overwhelming issue is that China has recognized the weakness of the U.S. The U.S. is not as strong as it used to be. I would even question whether the U.S. military is the most powerful military in the world any longer. I'm not sure about that. You know, the current staff of the U.S. military is about 450,000. At the recent recruitment test, with standards lowered because they cannot get enough recruits, soldiers, only 23% passed the test. And in the old days, it was the sons in the south of the U.S. because they didn't have enough jobs in the southern part of the U.S. that joined the military, and not the northerners. The northerners had their jobs. Now the jobs have moved south. So the southerners do not need to go to the military. So it's a big problem for the U.S. to recruit. And I know from some of my American relatives that younger people, they enlist themselves for reserves, but they do not believe that they will ever be called. I think they will be called. Russia has now 1.5 million troops, and they can easily draw 5 more million. At the present time, they have no problem with recruitment. China has built up its army dramatically. Neil Ferguson said, by the way, that the U.S. Needs 10 years to be ready for war. 10 years. So that's not my number, but I can see that. So I think the U.S. has really a severe problem, and it begins with the leadership and the people behind the leadership. And I think China has realized that, and they are making noises. China does not intervene in other countries. They are business people. They are interested to do more business. And of course, they create dependencies and they want to trade more, but they do not want to do that at the terms of the U.S. And the U.S. is trying to stop China from rising. And you see the sanctions and in technology in particularly. I think the Taiwan issue is not really an issue because longer term, the two would integrate. Taiwan would integrate. They are natural Chinese. In the current elections, the two opposition parties have in the polls a slight majority of 53%, but they couldn't agree of the candidates. So both candidates are running. It could still be that a few days before election, one candidate endorses his votes to the other one. If that happens, it would mean that the situation in China, between China and Taiwan, would relax dramatically. So there are 50% of the population who would be in favor of a rapprochement, of a relaxed relationship and a better relationship, and it would start and integrate automatically over time. I think the U.S. is using Taiwan as a provocation, as they used Ukraine as a provocation. This is part of the game.
So what about Saudi Arabia? Where do they stand in this? Because for many, many years, they have basically done the U.S.'s bidding in terms of oil production, oil prices. They've been a staunch ally in the region. And obviously, the petrodollar agreement has allowed pretty much everything that's happened over the last 50, 60, 70 years to happen. The strength of America, the universal adoption of the dollar. It's created this entire financial system that is dollar dependent, and that's been nothing but good news for America. Now, the Saudis, if you pay attention, are definitely playing both sides of the fence. They're definitely kind of cozying up to the Chinese as well as the Americans. They're definitely more resistant to pressure from America to basically stop the production cuts, for example, that they extended recently. That's not something that I think would have happened 4 or 5 years ago. What's the Saudis' position? What's their ultimate aim, do you think? And what ultimately is in their best interest in terms of which side of this divide to fall? Or should they just stay in the middle and just keep trying to get concessions from both sides?
I think the strongman in Saudi Arabia, MBS, as he's called, he sees the problem that he needs to create jobs for the young people. And he wants to develop the economy. So he's very business-minded to develop their own economy. That's what is in his mind. He sees, of course, that the U.S. longer term can become oil independent. And therefore, the U.S. is not necessarily the long-term partner for Saudi Arabia. And therefore, he has turned to China and opened that door as well and has a very good relationship with China. China is now their biggest customer. And he also terminated the petrodollar. The petrodollar does not exist anymore. They are selling their oil in other currencies than the U.S. dollar. That is a long-term weak point for the U.S. dollar, but it will not happen overnight. You know, it will not weaken the U.S. dollar overnight, but it's a structural process of weakening of the U.S. dollar and weakening of the U.S. position geopolitically in the world and economically. So I think he is very business-minded. He has been very arrogant relative to the U.S. You know, Blinken was recently in Saudi Arabia. He left them waiting 7 hours in front of his office door. I mean, you don't do that if you want to have a nice partnership. So he shows his disrespect for the current administration. He went much better along with Trump. And obviously, it's an autocratic country, and he respects powerful people or strong appearing people. And I think Saudi Arabia is interested to have peace in the region. They are not interested in having war. What the Arab countries, not just Saudi Arabia, all the others, they want a two-nation solution in Palestine. But I'm not sure that is still possible because the West Bank has now so many Israeli settlements. It's very difficult to do that. So that will be tricky. And for that, we need good diplomats, you see. I think war alone cannot lead to a final conclusion. You need some war, maybe, but also diplomatic skills to come to a final conclusion. I do not know what the conclusion is, but Saudi Arabia is definitely not interested in war. They had a problem with Iran. You know, it's Shiites against the Sunnis, and it's like the Protestants against the Catholics in the Middle Age. But I think that seems to be solved to a certain degree, and it was not the U.S. who created that rapprochement of Iran and Saudi Arabia. It was China. And it tells you that the new power broker in the region is now more China than the U.S. The U.S. is very one-sided on Israel's side, but it has lost the respect of the Arab nations, as it has lost the respect of many BRIC nations. And therefore, I think China can come in. Whether China will be able to lead to a solution, I don't know. But it's a different world than it used to be. We have to keep that in mind. And the Europeans, they are completely asleep because they depend on oil from the Middle East. They should be very active diplomatically, and they are not. They are asleep at the wheel.
I couldn't agree more with all of that. You know, it's funny, normally you and I, 3 or 4 years ago, we'd have talked markets and maybe ultimately touched on geopolitics. And now it's a sign of how the world's changed that we have to talk about geopolitics, because as go those geopolitical cross currents, so go markets. And so let's kind of switch back to markets now. And I guess as we're talking about the BRICS and we're talking about that part of the world, I want to go back to commodities. You know, you mentioned that there would be some positive tailwinds for commodities, and we haven't seen that for some time. And certainly commodity investors keep getting these fake false dawns where they think that, okay, now's the time the commodity complex is going to run, and it kind of disappoints. We're recording this the day after gold blasted through its all-time high in US dollars. It was pegged back, which was inevitable, I guess. So let's talk about the commodity complex, what you see in terms of timings, in terms of how you see those kind of waves flowing from here into 2024 and perhaps on to 2025, and the particular commodities you think which are going to benefit the most from what happens going forward in this part of the world.
When you look at the commodity prices or commodity index historically, there is an index, I got it from Barry Bannister of Stifel, 260 years of a commodity index. And when you take each cycle peak, the 10 years before the peak and the 20 years after the peak, and you overlay all of those together, you get the pattern. And the pattern is the 10 years up in the peak, and then you get the big shakeout down. And from the low of the cycle, you get two rallies. And the first rally we had 2020 to 21. And then you have an interim decline, and we are in the later stages of that decline for the commodity complex. That is, of course, oil and base metals much more than gold and the grains, etc. And I think that low we will see sometimes in the first half of next year. And when we see that low, we then go into the second big rally, probably to new highs in the commodity complex. And that will be due to the stimulation, as I explained, when we have the markets down and we have unrest and we have geopolitical problems and the economy is not doing well, then authorities will stimulate. And then we have that second run up, probably into 26 or something like that. And after that, you get a crisis. You get an economic crisis, because with the rise in commodities, you get the rise in inflation and in interest rates and bond yields. And that triggers an economic crisis. And because the next rise in rates will go higher than the current one and in bond yields too, we will have a severe crisis. The economic problems I expect for 24, that's a soft crisis, a milder version. The big crisis I expect then for 26, 27, 28 or so. And then I think we will see our fiat currencies decline dramatically, because the authorities have no other option left than trying to print us out of the mess, and it will create a debacle in the currencies. You know, unlike the 1930s, when you had a gold-anchored currency and it was stable throughout the Depression years and they let the economy go down, the situation today from the institutional setup is completely different. You have fiat currencies and you have a new Marxist type of philosophy among governments that the planning economy has to work. If the economy doesn't work, we need the planning economy. So they will underwrite the economy and let the currencies go down. And expressed in declining currencies, commodities will have a hell of a rally into the late 20s. And gold, of course, will be part of that. Gold broke out recently and is reversing now today. Gold went up for the wrong reasons. Gold went up for geopolitical reasons. And usually, historically, when gold went up for geopolitical reasons, it was not a trend that was sustainable. It was a short-term affair always. And the interesting thing about the rise in gold in recent weeks was that it rose together with real interest rates. And the big rise in gold in the 1970s that many of the gold bugs have in mind was against declining real interest rates. So it was a monetary affair, inflation and monetary affair. This is not the case right now. It will become so later on, but I think it's too early for that. So I think we have a shakeout in gold short term, but I think the current rally can still go to 2300 or something like that, then pull back to maybe 2100, But it goes higher after that because of our fiat currencies going down the drain.
Can you wrap Bitcoin into that same parcel?
Well, it's a bit different. You know, it's the new thing, the new kid around the block that attracts everybody's fantasy, of course. It's the new thing. And it's a little bit like gold. It is sold as a safe asset, which it isn't. It is not a safe asset. It is an asset that is limited in terms of future supply. So you know that it is limited. And there is a scarcity factor attached to it. And I think what really triggered the Bitcoin to rally recently was that the SEC finally agreed that the large investment banks could launch ETFs. That means that, like in a chain letter system, you come up with a new layer of new letter writers, you see? So you have new potential buyers coming in that will be attracted and brought to the market by the large investment banks. And that is, of course, attractive. So I think Bitcoin will rise further on a cycle trend basis. The low we hit, when did we hit the low? At 15,000 or so?
16, yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, around there. So I think it could go higher. Whether it goes to 100,000 or higher or not, I do not know. I do not know what the intrinsic value is. You know, in gold, we have some experience. In gold, they always say gold should be about the price of an expensive suit. And when you look long term, that really worked. Some people are buying a suit for $3,000, no question. So I could see that. We have no experience what Bitcoin is worth. I don't understand the intrinsic value.
Yeah, I'm similar, and I try not to spend too much time talking about it because it's just not something I'm massively interested in. So let's switch to the bond market then, because we saw in March with the Silicon Valley Signature Bank debacle, we saw what was laid bare were these horrendous mark-to-market losses that were held on bank balance sheets, you know, and these risk-free assets that they've been herded into. We've seen Bank of America come out and talk about having, I think it was $130 billion of mark-to-market losses in their own treasury holdings. What does this mean for the treasury? What does this mean for what the treasury has to do? What does this mean in terms of how it maybe shapes Federal Reserve policy in terms of trying to protect these mark-to-market losses? And what does it mean going forward for the broader bond market in terms of crowding in private money or crowding out private money and what the Treasury has to do? Because they have an awful lot of issuance coming up and somehow they have to walk an incredibly fine line here between, say, protecting those balance sheets and also making sure they can sell more bonds than I'm sure they wish they had to sell.
And the interest rate question and the interest rate service question for the Treasury as well, you know. It's a delicate issue. I think Yellen has been trying to prevent the disaster and therefore issued as few treasuries as possible on the long bond side, 10 years and up. And she issued almost over 90%, way over 90% she issued in the bills and at the short end, trying to protect the bond market to not create a big problem there because of the banks also. The banks, of course, do not have to sell. The only problem is they cannot make a lot of new loans if they are deep in the losses. You know, so it's a restraining factor. But if the bond market recovers, then they can sell at higher prices later. My hunch is that we have not seen what we usually see at the peak of the bond yield cycle. We usually see an event. We usually see a credit event, a large company going bust, or a market crash, or a recession, or anything like that. Anything bad that happens due to the rise in bond yields. That has not happened for the first time in modern history. So I always said something is wrong here. But I saw at the same time that the technicals were setting up for a good move in bond yields down. And the cyclical indicator suggests that we go down to about 3% or so, plus minus 25 basis points. And the medium-term indicator suggests that we go down to about 370 in my work. And I think that will happen. And the first down is behind us. We bounce now for maybe 2 weeks, and then we go further down. And then we are in Q1. And then the time will come up where Jay Powell has to decide which way he wants to go. If some economic numbers come through on the more positive side, and if he hikes or if he doesn't hike, doesn't matter, bond yields will go up again. And the question is, the stronger the economic numbers are and the consensus of the soft landing gets tested or gets thrown out of the window, then you have a problem in the bond market. And it could be a sharp move to the other side because of the extreme positioning that we see in the bond market. But even if it happens, it will not be sustainable and it will not last long, and we will come all the way back down to the 3% level with a recession-type situation in the economy by mid-year, I would say, by mid-year. After that, I think we are ready for the second upcycle in rates and bond yields. You know, we have a secular trend change. We had 40 years down in interest rates and inflation, and we bottomed in the 2020. I even entitled my report in June 2020, Sell of a Generation for Bonds. And I had a report in 81, The Buy of a Generation. So I'm a long-term timer, you see. And I think we had the first upcycle is almost over. And then we start the second upcycle in, let's say, summer, late summer 24. And that will probably run into late 20s. And it will go much higher than most people believe. I think we go close to 10% in 10-year treasuries. So it could be a hell of a crisis that we create. And it will be accompanied by a fiscal crisis, by an economic crisis, probably also a geopolitical crisis and an economic crisis. So I think the later part of the 20s will not be very pleasant. And the most attractive asset is having an open mind and remain flexible.
Yeah, I think that's such good advice. And your roadmaps make that so clear. Every time we talk about this, you know, the way you can think in both directions is always so valuable for people to hear, because, you know, right now, all I'm reading in financial media and Twitter and everywhere else is people saying, okay, you just buy bonds now and just be long. No one talks about this is a tactical trade and we have a, you know, maybe a 3 to 4 month window here to be long bonds. It's that's it. The all clear siren's over. The rate rises are done. You can just buy bonds and sit on them forever now. And I think that's such a dangerous way to think about markets. You know, your idea that they move in both directions, you would think would be common sense to people, but we've just become so accustomed to these long trending markets supported and abetted by central banks that people forget they go the other direction. We're kind of running up on time now, but let me just ask you one more question. That is about Japan. You know, Japan is something I know that you've looked at many times in your career. I've been looking at it this last year, and it strikes me as Japan is a place that offers some real potential to make some money in a sea change environment. What's your take on the changes being forced upon the Bank of Japan and what those changes might mean, not just to domestic Japanese allocations, but probably more importantly, capital flows around the world as Japan potentially starts to bring capital home?
Capital flows is really the key to Japan because the Japanese yen is the most undervalued currency in the world. And as long as the Bank of Japan does not change policy, the yen will remain weak. It has turned here medium term for a correction, but for a cycle turn, it needs to be accompanied by economic steps. And we need a central bank that is tightening and moves away from yield curve control. All they have done so far is they have increased the level of the yield curve, but it's still yield curve control. And it's still at a relatively low level. I think they need a problem, and the problem is called inflation, and inflation is picking up. if I'm not mistaken, is around 4% or something like that. If they are serious and want to bring down inflation to 1% again for the long term, they have to tighten monetary policy. If they tighten monetary policy, the yen will fly. The yen would fly. You know, whenever that happens, with the huge positioning out there, the yen has been the most attractive funding currency by everybody in the world. So the whole world is short yen. And once that changes, then you have a big move. I have played the yen many times. And I recall 1998, when the yen moved from dollar yen from 148 to 108 within about 3 weeks. I was on the right side of the trade and Julian Robertson was on the other side. And I told him before, I called him up and said, Julian, be careful. I think there is a big problem out there. And I think we could see something very similar again. I'm not sure whether it is now already, because I haven't seen the signs from the Bank of Japan yet. So it could very well be that we have now a weakening dollar and the dollar yen comes down from 150 to 142 or something like that. And then we have another strengthening dollar sometimes in the first half of 24, particularly if bond yields would go up again. And if that happened, I wouldn't be surprised to see 160 on dollar yen. Once we see that, then we are in for a big change. And then I think you will have a move back down to 100 or so. So it will be a big move. It's very high up on my monitor list.
Yeah, you and me both. Okay, well, listen, I promised that was the last question, but I have to ask you one more. At the risk of upsetting the usual cast of characters, there seems to have been a shift in terms of the climate change agenda. You and I have spoken about this before, and I know that you've done a lot of work on this and looked at potentially the thing that could upend everything is a cooling cycle, which would catch the most number of people off guard. And certainly, you know, I've since talking to you and Simon Hunt, I've read a lot more about this, and I'm fascinated to understand it more, because I think you're right. If that did happen, it would catch an awful lot of people off guard. But there seems to have been a shift recently in terms of governments either trying to or being forced to kind of walk back climate policies because they're unaffordable and they don't allow for the right kind of transmission of energy into people's hands. What's your sense in what's happening there? Is that a trend that is likely to continue in terms of kind of trying to de-escalate the green agenda?
It's still high on the agenda, but it's slipping down. And there are still 80,000 people traveling to Doha, I think it is, for the World Climate Conference, and it's the 27th conference, and they cannot accomplish anything. So that's the bureaucrats. Forget it. If I read the cycles for climate correctly, then we are in for a change in climate, and the change, the peak, the theoretical peak is 25, and it should then be 30 years of cooling. Based on the cycles I follow, and I have followed the climate before it was fashionable in the early 80s, and I talked to many people who were experts in the field. I'm not an expert. I just follow what experts are saying. And all experts, not just the government-sponsored experts. So I think we are in for some cooling. What people are recognizing is it's not working. All the planning economy for green economy, it's simply not working. You can do a little bit, but you cannot do the amount that is needed to really become a green economy. You cannot achieve that. And we have burned a lot of money in projects that have been wasted. You know, many windmills are not operating anymore. They are throwing kerosene at windmills by helicopter that the windmills can still turn when it's so cold and things like that. It simply doesn't work. And what people were not aware of was that every solar or wind project needs a backup of conventional energy. And so it is not making any sense economically. And I think people or governments are being forced to recognize that it's not working. The worst have been the Germans, you see, and they have turned nuclear power off and they are burning coal. And they say it's all for the sake of a better environment. You know, this is a joke, of course. I think a lot of damage has been done. A lot of companies have been burned. A lot of write-offs have happened. And therefore, the appetite of going green big way is declining. I think the fad is over.
What does that mean in terms of, because it's not just an economic thing, right? This has become such a strong debate amongst people. And you know, when you and I have spoken about this before, it's amazing how people can be completely open-minded about a conversation you and I might have on which way the market could go in both directions. But as soon as we introduce the idea that, well, you know, the climate could potentially go in both directions, it has over time, people shut down immediately. So if that fad is over, what do you think that means both for the broader debate and for the green agenda?
Well, for the broader debate, I think it means that governments will have more money for more intelligent investments. The religious part of those who hear that the world will go under because of climate change, I think that religious group will be shrinking over time. And I think it has peaked. There will still be heated debates in society, but I think the more we see that it's not working, the more people will jump off the bandwagon, and you will see journalists addressing the problem from the other angle, and then more and more people reading about this. So I think in 5 years' time, you can discuss climate change in a more relaxed environment. In recent years, you could hardly discuss it pragmatically. I think that will change, and governments will have more money for more intelligent investments. And it also means that conventional energy will stay, will have an important role in our economies. And that means that our dependence from the Middle East will remain in place.
All right, Felix, look, I hope we can discuss all these things in a more pragmatic way in 5 years, hopefully sooner. But listen, I thank you again for your time. I love every chance I get to sit and chat with you. I prefer it in person, but if we have to do it via Zoom, then so be it. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. And I look forward to doing this again at the same time next year, hopefully. And maybe there's a chance you and I'll catch up in person in between now and then.
Chatting with you is such a pleasure, Brent. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you. And all the best to you. We keep in touch.
You bet, for sure. Thanks very much. Well, there you go, folks. Another terrific conversation with Felix Zouloff. Nobody, and I mean nobody, analyzes markets the way he does and is so open to trying to figure out in every facet of markets which way they can go in both directions and try and play it accordingly. His roadmaps are always invaluable. They've been as accurate as you could possibly hope to be when looking at the future. And so what he had to say today was, I think, incredibly important. For anybody who was triggered by the conversation at the end about climate, I apologize, but I think it's an important conversation to have. And I think, as I said, you know, if we're able to keep an open mind in terms of which way markets will go in order to try and either safeguard ourselves or increase our wealth, then I think it's important to be able to do the same thing with climate. And I'm certainly always fascinated to get Felix's take on that. Felix's service is absolutely invaluable. You'll find more about it at felixzouloff.com, and I would encourage you to look at Felix's service and if it's appropriate, then sign up for it, because you will never find a dissatisfied customer of Felix Zouloff. I promise you, try as you might. So my thanks to Felix again for that time. My thanks to you for listening. I'll be back with another guest in the very near future. In the meantime, as always, thank you very much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.